Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Friday, April 26, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. Also, on the program today, Katie Mann, writer, philosopher at Cornell University, author of Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. I'm a little distracted because I'm on vacation right now. And in fact, as you hear this, I am rounding up the kids to get onto the plane to fly back from Florida. I honestly, it could have been the best experience of my life where my kids were overjoyed. They had so much fun. Dad, you were great. Thanks so much for planning this way in advance. Because, you know, you get out ahead of it. It wasn't cheap, but it wasn't crazy expensive. Or they could be like, why did you go to the worst version of this? In Florida, not even on the ocean. Who goes to Florida to go to a river? And I didn't meet any friends. I didn't like anybody there. I was bored. I don't like to swim. We all slept in the same room. God knows how that worked out. Every night I got to put Saul to bed at 7:30 and then I'm done for the evening. And I just sit there and watch YouTube videos, I guess, and drink on the... I don't even think it has a porch. I don't... What am I going to do? We're going to have to sit in the hallway. Oh, God. So, anyways, I'm back on the plane. Thank God. Thank God. This conversation with Katie Mann, really fascinating about misogyny, no pun intended, I guess. But you will enjoy this. I know one of the things I probably did on the trip, if the kids, because everybody told me, like, if you go to like a Club Med, they're pros and they can entertain all the kids. And I've never been, obviously, and it's not the type of thing I would have thought I would have gone to. But I'm single. Parent on this trip, and so I needed the help, and so hopefully what happened is I sent the kids off and then I start to meditate. How did I do it? Well, Majority Report today being supported in part by Simple Habit. It's a mobile app, Simple Habit, that provides massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. Here's the thing, I'm relatively new to meditation. And Simple Habit works, regardless of whether you're the type of person who has a specific agenda as to what you want to accomplish with meditation, regardless of whether you have set goals or how much experience you've had with meditation. And this audience can try Simple Habit totally for free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. The benefits of meditation, everybody, I think, at this point accepts it, right? You've seen the data. You've heard the anecdotes about it. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with. They have meditations that are designed specifically for when you're waking up or you're on your lunch break, when you've just gotten home from work, when you're about to go to bed. They have it guided meditations for mindfulness, for when you have important things going on at work, for anxiety, if you're suffering from some depression, or when you're having trouble falling asleep, Meditation is when you want to overcome procrastination. Meditation is designed for parents. The variety of guided meditations on Simple Habit is what sets it apart. And that's why Simple Habit just won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Well-Being App. It's available on iOS, for Android, and the web browser. The Majority Report audience can try it for free by going to simplehabit.com/majority. And if you're watching on YouTube, we've got links below the description. If you're listening, we've got links in the podcast description. Check it out. Check it out today. Also, one of our sponsors today is Skillshare. We've talked about them quite a bit. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing to photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, everything in between. And anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport2 is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library. They've got super high quality online courses and tutorials. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that's going to be useful for you both in your personal life and in your professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing or you want to learn to do something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. I've been checking out, well, on my list of stuff to watch, I'm doing the entrepreneurship hustle from business plan to real success. I'm checking out the bookkeeping for freelancers. That's exactly what I need. I'm doing a course on branding. There's one that's creating art that sells. A worker's artist guide. I figure that might have some help for me. Yeah, that's the thing is you don't know what things are going to stick. Productivity habits that stick. Using time theming. That is something, right? Yeah. I saw you nod your head, Matt. You're on that. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. Again, that's skl.sh/majorityreport2. And I put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube. Again, if you're listening, it's in the podcast description. We will be back on Monday. I mean, unless like this vacation was such a disaster that I need to like take another couple of days. Just because I can't handle it, which is not, I don't want to say this, it's not impossible. I could have made just a massive mistake. But this interview with Katie Mann, where you get a notion of exactly like what is misogyny in today's society? What does it actually mean? How does it compare to sexism? What is it in the context of public life and politics? Katie Mann is a writer and philosopher at Cornell. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll listen to her discuss Down Girl, the logic of misogyny. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of the Sage School of Philosophy at Cornell University, Kate Mann, author of Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. Welcome to the program, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so let's start with just I want to say the definition of misogyny, but I know that we'll get there if we just start with the distinction between sexism and misogyny as you lay it out.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think of sexism as an ideology which naturalizes and rationalizes a patriarchal social order, whereas misogyny I analogize to the law enforcement branch of patriarchy. So for a kind of slogan, you can think of sexism as wearing the lab coat and misogyny going on witch hunts.
Sexism is wearing the lab coat and misogyny is going on witch hunts. I mean, so are they part mm-hmm. of the same? I mean, they're obviously part of the same system, but what one is Well, so let's start with the sexism in the context of establishing the patriarchy. I mean, I think I hope that most of our audience at least has a reasonably sound concept of this. But I mean, walk us through that. What does that mean? I guess in practice, and then we'll talk about some of the sort of more recent examples that in some ways inspired maybe your work, but certainly were points of departure.
Yeah. So one way of thinking about it is that sexist ideology will often come up with reasons why it just makes sense for women to be in patriarchal service positions. So maybe we can think about certain quite dubious sort of pseudo-scientific findings that women are more caring or empathic or nurturing by nature, supposedly, whereas what subsequent research often reveals is that if you incentivize men, they end up being as empathic as women on average. So it's both bad science, and it's also science that kind of makes sense of patriarchal social roles, like women being in positions of pleasing and serving and caring and nurturing, rather than having a more egalitarian distribution of labor. Does that make sense? To think about it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I mean that is in one, I guess, sort of like the sort of the roles that are assigned to us, based on sex, in one particular realm. But I imagine it's more. It's also you have more to say on it more broadly throughout society.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can also look at the flip side of this, which is kind of rationalizing, naturalizing men playing, men being in leadership positions and being in positions of male-dominated authority. So I think of sexism and misogyny as often working in tandem. So the sexism kind of justifies reserving those positions, those masculine-coded leadership positions for men, and misogyny then kind of comes in and enforces it when sexist ideology proves insufficient to keep those positions reserved for usually privileged men.
Okay, so yeah, so how does that, I mean, give us an example of how that would work. I mean, so if sexism is the sort of the law and misogyny is the club that makes sure that, we or women follow the law. I mean, give us an example of how misogyny does that.
Yeah, so I think often the form that it takes is punishing, showing resentment and other kind of negative reactive, hostile attitudes to women who are non-conforming in some way. So that could mean being perceived as being insufficiently caring. It could mean taking away something which men are perceived as entitled to, such as said leadership positions. Or it could be being deviant along gendered lines by being not clearly conforming to the gender binary or being a trans woman. I think a lot of different possible violations of patriarchal law and order are possible and then result in these kind of punitive, resentful, and hostile attitudes.
You write that that there is a naive conception of misogyny. What, tell us what that is,
right,
and why.
Yeah, so I think of my work as being opposed to this naive conception of misogyny, according to which misogyny is hatred for any and every woman, or at least women very generally. And the reason why I think that that conception makes misogyny a kind of very rare property, almost a priori, so before we've even investigated the society, is given that patriarchal roles involve women pleasing and serving men, it would be really strange if someone wanted to bite the hand that soothes and serves them. So I think misogyny is much more about trying to get non-conforming women in line, although it's not restricted to that. It also can involve punching down behavior, so taking advantage of the fact that women are often in more vulnerable positions in a patriarchal society. But it does often have this effect where it singles out as targets or victims women who are perceived as quote-unquote bad women.
Okay, so you got to walk me through this a little bit more. So this the idea that it is simply some type of psychological manifestation doesn't make sense insofar as because of the role that women play in society?
Yeah. Think about it like this. So here's an analogy I think is helpful. So imagine that someone just hates restaurants, and it doesn't matter how much the restaurant pleases exactly their palate or their sensibility or their aesthetics. They're just against restaurant simpliciter. That's kind of an odd psychological disposition. But the naive conception of misogyny makes misogyny out to be kind of like that. So no matter how much women are pleasing and serving and loving and performing service with a smile, it makes out misogyny to be this universal hatred of women despite all of that. And that's just kind of odd psychologically to think that no matter how good she is at basically, performing certain, service functions and performing reproductive, emotional, social, and domestic labor, to think that she'd still be disliked or hated despite all of that, it would make misogyny a very rare property rather than one that we actually have to take a look and see how much or how little it's instantiated in any given milieu.
Let me just play devil's advocate here and using your restaurant analogy.
Yeah, sure.
I'm hungry, and the only place for me to get food is restaurants, but I resent restaurants because of that. Why?
So I think that's one form misogyny can take. So I sort of think about people in the position of being hungry and waiting to be served and becoming resentful in particular of a server who seems to be not serving them and who seems maybe to be waiting on other tables. They feel entitled to her service, and maybe they start banging their spoon on the table. Maybe they explode in rage and frustration. I think that that my conception of misogyny can help make sense of that. So it can count as misogyny, that outburst, that bad entitled behavior, when you have an environment where certain men are socialized to think that they're entitled to women's sexual, social, and emotional, as well as reproductive services. And then they don't hate any and every woman. They more target women who they feel denied by or rejected by. And that, I think, is actually a common locus for misogynist aggression.
I mean, that is also, in some respects, ostensibly the one of the jumping off points of your book, as you talk about Elliot Rodger. For those, I mean, I think we spoke about it briefly on the show back at the time. And I should also say, I think maybe I know I have this in the back of my head, but if people are hearing some type of like echoes of Jordan Peterson, maybe it's I'm coming into this predisposed and aware of what you've written about his book and his relationship. We will get there, but let's start with Elliot Rodgers. He was a young man in California, in Isla Vista, who killed, I think it was five or six people, as well as injuring, I think, about a dozen, maybe more.
He injured 13 and killed six and then killed himself.
And okay, so why was that killing? Why was that, if not a catalyst, at the very least, a jumping off point for you?
Yeah, so he had posted YouTube videos in which he stated that he was lashing out in order to wreak vengeance on the, quote, hot blonde sluts, unquote, who he perceived as rejecting him. So he targeted, his primary targets for this act were the women of the Alpha Phi sorority house at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who he perceived as kind of representative of the kinds of women who he wanted to have pay him attention, affection, and give him love and sex. But he said that they gave these things to other men, but never to me. So he has this line in the video, it has been very torturous, sort of plaintive line. And so on the day of retribution, the so-called day of retribution, he lashed out initially at his three roommates, three men, stabbed them to death, then uploaded his final YouTube video. He had a whole string of them that was similar in tenor, and then he drove to the Alpha Phi sorority house at UCSB and tried to get let in the door. But his pounding sounded so loud and aggressive that the women inside decided not to open up, even when the pounding continued for at least another full minute. And it's very fortunate that those women didn't open the door because he had come knocking with loaded gun in his hand, planning to eviscerate all of them. And when he was turned away, not let in the door, he lashed out and shot at three women walking outside around the corner. They were members of a nearby sorority house, Tri Delta. He killed two and wounded one of them, and then went on a random or seemingly random drive-by shooting spree. And he ended up killing another young man at a delicatessen before eventually police closed in on him. And he was found dead at the wheel, his car on fire, having shot himself. So those were the events, and the reason why that they provoked such controversy was partly that it was clear that his primary targets were these women at the Alpha Phi sorority house, but there was also collateral damage in terms of who he lashed out at. So it's important to be able to recognize that misogynistic attacks are compatible with attacks of other kinds as well. In this case, against young men who he killed four of. But that doesn't make the two deaths of the young women involved any less misogynistic.
Right. They were supportive in some way of the, I guess, for, you know, simplistically, the bad behavior of these women who were not subjecting themselves to the role that that this guy thought that they should have in the context of a patriarchal society, I guess. I mean, this is...
I think that's exactly right. He felt deprived of a hot blonde girlfriend who he recognized would enhance his social status, and he became incredibly resentful that no woman had kind of turned up ready to be his, his source of confidence, as well as, giving him said love, affection, sex, and all the rest of it. But yeah, rather than the attitude being that of being bummed or disappointed, it was a degree of entitlement where he felt that he not only was permitted to, but ought to lash out at women for kind of sins of omission. So at no particular woman, but to representative women who he felt deprived by for this sin of omission of not being someone who played that role in his life.
And, you know, this is where, you know, we start to hear sort of like, you know, people talk about like incels. And this is the when we talk about that community, is it is the, you know, so-called oppression of incels, involuntarily celibate, is sort of, that's the framing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how is it that guy is not just merely dismissed as being nuts, right? I mean, that's really the implication is the guy, I mean, or I should say the sort of prevailing wisdom is he's just crazy. And it just, his craziness took this form, but it is.
Yeah.
I mean, expand on why it's not just a random that he took this form. I mean, it could have taken, I guess, a couple of other forms, but it took this one.
Yeah, right.
And why does that form even exist, I guess?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think one thing that's telling is that women don't tend to lash out in this way. And it's not that women can't be sexually or romantically disappointed. It's that it takes a different and, I think, typically less toxic form. I mean, the other thing worth noting here is that Roger's behavior was striking in a number of ways, but it also shared in common several things with crimes that happen 2 to 3 times a day in the U.S. of women being murdered by a current or former intimate partner when she tries to leave. So those kinds of domestic violence or intimate partner violence homicides have quite a bit in common with Roger's crime, the sense that he is entitled to her and that if she tries to leave, that he has the right to take her out.
I mean,
that kind of misogyny is ubiquitous.
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, you know, there's not only obviously is we see domestic violence is far more often perpetrated by males than females. I mean, it certainly happens that females also commit domestic violence against male partners.
Mm-hmm.
But that dynamic of choosing, you know, to have women who are representative of the class that of people, that to me seems much more unique in that sense. That, like, I don't know of, I mean, maybe I think, you know, I'm trying to think of like something, maybe Eileen Wuornos, who was the only female serial killer. I mean, maybe mm-hmm. on some level there was that quality, but, you know, the idea that he would go out.
It's incredibly rare.
It's incredibly rare, but the idea that, you know, the idea though that he would go out and it wasn't a particular woman as much as a class or a type of woman who he was going to punish to send a message.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's what makes a lot of these crimes quite scary. It's that, I mean, these women he had not approached them. It wasn't that they'd actually concretely rejected him. He had stalked them from a distance. But his complaint was that they really literally hadn't turned up on his, you know, his proverbial doorstep ready to date him. And that kind of resentment of that class of woman, and again, resenting no particular woman for a sin of omission, but rather, that type of woman, the quote, hot blonde slut, unquote, that he perceived as rejecting him. That makes for a kind of act that, it's certainly true that only a tiny percentage of men do this, but it's almost exclusively men who do that. So it's crucial that we hang on to that distinction between, it's true, it's of course true, not all men, but it's almost only men
right.
who do this, and it's usually typically women who bear the brunt of that aggression.
And this guy is obviously a marginal figure. But I guess the idea is that what's in within the margins is this, you know, I guess a gendered economy, right? And
yeah.
And mm-hmm. it just expand on what that gendered economy is that in its most marginal and extreme forms leads to this type of disciplining of the class of women who are not, you know, doing as they're supposed to in the context of this economy.
Yeah, no, that's a very good way to put it. And I mean, and again, just to emphasize, I do think these kinds of acts are marginal, but continuous with ubiquitous acts of domestic violence and domestic violence homicide. But what I think of there being this as a general kind of overarching way of thinking about misogyny in the U.S. today, because I certainly wouldn't want to deny that we've made considerable and obvious feminist social progress in an egalitarian direction. But I do think there is an uneven economy of giving and taking where she is, you know, within, let's say, let's think about relations between, you know, a man and a woman who, let's suppose that they're privileged in various ways, so white, cis, het, and similar age, and let's suppose wealthy and non-disabled too, to just make it a kind of initially epistemically clean case for these purposes. She is often held to be obligated to give designated men, so men who she's in a relationship with, certain kinds of feminine-coded goods like, well, for one thing, sex, for another thing, children, but also various kinds of moral goods like love, attention, affection, the very things that Roger felt deprived of. And he, on the other hand, is held to be entitled to take these things from her. And if she is not providing those kinds of goods, there is often a really, you know, damaging, pernicious, and scary logic to it where he is held to be entitled to claim those goods from her or from someone, such that there is a sense that he is sexually entitled, and hence the phenomenon of not really punishing or holding responsible these, you know, very privileged, I call them hyper-privileged golden boys, when they take things like sex in rape from women.
And are these goods, I mean, simply you refer to them as moral goods, but I mean, to some degree, are they not also material?
Yes, I absolutely. So I think it's a combination. So often the service, the kind of domestic, reproductive, and, you know, child-rearing service is absolutely partly material. And it, I think it's also useful to acknowledge it has this moral dimension to it, so that women are required not just to give certain things to men, but to do so with a proverbial smile and with a kind of transparency of mind, so that she's not just perceived as giving these things, but giving them freely and lovingly and willingly. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. And I mean it's... But I wonder, I mean, if the moral follows the material, right? Like even like the loving and the attention, that's to help
yeah.
me when I get home from work. And it's going to increase my productivity. And that's a marketing value. And also, I don't want to have to question whether you're just doing this for, you know, for your own material gains. Like we're
yeah.
not partners in this endeavor. Because if I have a sense that you are, you know, you are loving me when I come home and you are taking care of the kids because we're part of some type of like, you know, business arrangement, that doesn't, you know, that puts you on even more of an equal footing with me than I'm comfortable with. It's just like, I'm giving
yeah.
you this stuff and I do it because you are, you provide me with such attention that it makes me feel good.
Yeah, it has to feel good. It has to feel both natural, willing, loving, and all the rest of it. And I think it's right that it's not meant to feel transactional, even though in some sense, if you look at this, you know, if you take a bird's eye view of this, it looks very much like a kind of moral transaction. But I think part of it too is, you know, these kinds of exchanges are very much embedded in a capitalist system in, you know, the U.S. Context. So it's partly about patching him up at the end of the day, where he might have, you know, a damaged body as well as a damaged ego due to genuinely oppressive capitalist forces at work. And yeah, it makes a lot of sense within an overall capitalist, within late stage capitalism, that we would still want women performing certain kinds of ego boosting and patching up roles in order to restore a widget maker to full widget making capacity by morning.
Is it a relevant question at this point to ask, like, what came first, the sort of the moral justification for the sexism, or the sexism providing support for, like I'd say, a capitalist system or maybe some other system,
yeah.
And the morality being like the more righteous rationale for it.
Yeah, I love that question, and I share that question. I don't feel like I have an answer to it. I feel like that's probably a question for an anthropologist or a historian of gender. And my tendency is to offer a kind of analysis of a snapshot of what we get in the here and now, and then leave those kinds of ideological questions to people who can really comment on the full historical development of these relations and the fact that they've been, until quite recently, so consistent across time. Because that's a fascinating aspect of this, that, you know, feminist social progress is a historical anomaly. And I think we have to be very careful that we don't go back.
So let's talk a little bit about the present time. I mean, there are two things that obviously you write about the response to Hillary Clinton in 2016 and what drives that. And I'm particularly interested in the idea of, like, I mean, you're looking at misogyny from the perspective of the victim versus the perpetrator. And I mean, speak to that on just that level, because I mean, I have this theory that, you know, to the extent that people could be misogynist, you know, could have, or even racist on some level, and voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, that from the perspective of a perpetrator, which may be a little bit easier based on, you know, where I sit in the context of society, easier for me to relate to, is this notion of, like, you know, we're not going to have two non-normal presidents in a row. Like, you know, we gave you one non-normal president, and you know, and now you're coming back to us for another. That the distinction in the mind of someone who is racist is not just like, oh, I just dislike other people based upon their skin, as opposed to on their gender too. Like, the idea is like, you're just not like me, and therefore,
I think that's really interesting. Two things are maybe worth noting. So I think it's not necessarily a not like me, because white women, the majority of white women who voted, as of course you know, voted for Trump over Clinton. I think it's maybe, as you said earlier, an anomalous president, someone who isn't a traditional fit for this highly white-coded, masculine-coded, ultimate power position. And I think that there is a very real element of, people are reluctant to vest their trust and their kind of moral as well as a material support. They're reluctant to get behind non-traditional occupants of that kind of role. And I think equally importantly, they're reluctant to see a white man go down in terms of losing the election. So one set of empirical findings I've been really interested in is if you put men and women in head-to-head competitions for masculine-coded leadership positions, women tend really strikingly to lose out. So the majority of people will find her not competent if the information is ambiguous, and not likable if the information is unambiguous that she is just as competent as the man. And that is around 85% of people in one of these studies who would prefer the man to the woman, despite the fact that their personnel files were alternated on average. So on average, participants have the exact same information about the man and a woman competing for this vice president position at a company.
And the subjects
but participants
were,
in that study.
I'm sorry. The subjects.
Oh, sorry, go
were,
ahead.
The subjects were both men and women, or right?
Yes.
I mean, it's so wow, that's fascinating.
That's right. It was just as much an effect for women as men, and you often find that in studies like this that gender biases are as prevalent in women or nearly as prevalent in women as in men. You know, I've seen that effect quite a bit in these kinds of studies. And that suggests that it's not so much a being similar to oneself.
It's just a classic structure that's been set up. I mean, from my
right,
perspective,
exactly.
from my perspective as an aged white guy, it happens to be not like me, but it is from other perspective, it's just like not the norm, not the
exactly,
not the obvious answer, not the the.
Not someone we're comfortable with in that role,
right.
And not someone we're comfortable losing that kind of head-to-head fight.
What? I mean, you know, it reminds me on some level of the idea that black people can also maintain some perspective of white supremacy, that there is a structure that exists and they can buy into false narratives about black people in this country. And
I mean, I think that there is a parallel there, but I mean, I suspect white women are even, you know, white women are really need to be held accountable for perpetuating a lot of misogyny. So I think there's always a question about, you know, and I don't really want to comment, you know, as someone who's white, on exactly to what extent it's true that there can be false narratives internalized by black persons, say in the US. But I definitely think it's true that white women have internalized some very damaging misogynistic narratives. And also, by the same token, a false sense of obligation to uphold and support white men. So often it presents itself originally not as suspicion of the white woman, but rather as support for white men, both in one's own family, in excess of what's actually required or salutary, and also of white male politicians who are perceived as saviors or saints or good old boys, again, far in excess of what's actually epistemically and morally appropriate.
So, I mean, let's talk about when you talk about the results of that study that subjects found either the woman less qualified than the man, and when they found the woman more qualified, they found her less likable. I mean, it sounds like Hillary Clinton, frankly.
It does,
you know?
Doesn't it?
And
and
I should say, you know, this is where I have my obligatory caveat that I think there were a lot of different reasons why Hillary Clinton lost.
That seems
and,
right.
And with that said, you know, misogyny is real, and certainly it played a role in her loss, and I suspect it played a role in the narratives which were built about her, that some of which, you know, had some, I think, salience outside of the influence of misogyny, but some of which may have been like attenuated because of the misogyny.
Yeah, I mean, it's always very complicated because, you know, I'll be the first to say there were valid reasons to be concerned about her presidency, including from the left. I mean, my feeling was there's also various good, wonkish kind of questions about why exactly she lost. But then there's this question that I'm interested in of why it was even close. Because what everyone's concerns about her presidency, some of which I shared, some of which I didn't, it seemed to me that when it came down to it, the decision between Trump and Clinton should have been straightforward to reasonable people. So I think reasonable people could disagree about whether she would have been an adequate president or a terrific president as compared with Trump, but I don't think it's reasonable to have withheld one's vote for her, given those sort of basic realities that we were looking at, a white supremacist, misogynist, you know, going potentially into the White House, as he indeed did. So my feeling was, you know, there were a lot of narratives around her where there was a grain of truth. So, you know, there are certainly aspects of her record and her policy positions that were subject to genuine criticism. But then that often became, instead of a flaw, it became a fatal flaw. And people felt they couldn't, in good conscience, vote for her and were kind of excessively disgusted by aspects of her history that are of serious concern, but also didn't receive the same kind of censure in Obama, for example. So I think misogyny is complicated because it often involves zeroing in on genuine moral flaws and then kind of going nuts and holding them to be much more serious and much more disgusting than they actually are.
How does one parse those, or is it like, is that outside of your portfolio in terms of an individual, you know, parsing those versus, let's say, society?
Well, I tend to, you know, if someone tells me they didn't support her, I'm always less interested in assessing whether or not they were being misogynistic or biased along gender lines, to put it more mildly. And the flip side of that is I'm not interested in exonerating anyone. I think, though, as a kind of broad social question of why people were so reluctant to get behind Clinton in order to keep Trump out of the White House, misogyny does have a real explanatory role to play, including in ways in which, real problems with her potential presidency became exaggerated, whereas men with comparable problems got a comparatively free pass.
Did that misogyny co-mingle with, you know, I mean, it could have been, right, like a Donald Trump could have been horrible in some different way than he was horrible, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he could be just like, you know, even more obviously, let's say, incompetent. And yet,
he have been more obviously incompetent?
I mean, I'm trying to come up with a way in which he could be, you know, more horrible. I don't know what it would be, but let's say he wasn't also like explicitly misogynist, right? How much of his really explicit misogyny? You know, mm-hmm. Not everybody has 19, women, somewhere between a dozen and 19 women, I think it was, who, you know, had claimed that he had been sexually assaulted them or inappropriate in some fashion. Everybody out there has, you know, a recording of them saying the stuff that he said. Right.
Probably helped him. I think it was emboldening to people who felt up in arms about so-called political correctness, which it's really often an act of political correction. I feel like his shamelessness and his brazenness would have been very emboldening to watch.
And so,
it's hard to see how this breaks down in terms of numbers. I'm sure there were some Republicans who were put off him because of that bad behavior, because, you know, they have, you know, much more principled stance, and so maybe they ended up not voting for Clinton, but also not voting for Trump out of, again, conscience. So I think those people certainly exist, but I think there were other people who were really attracted to his loud, brash, unapologetic, and sort of id-like manifestations of these rogue desires that had crept up partly because people now are more subject to, I think, often appropriate corrections if they, you know, if they say something that is sexist or misogynistic, there's a greater chance of being brought to account for that. And I think people don't like that. I think some people have a really hard time, you know, getting used to that practice. And watching Trump mouth off was really liberating.
And I imagine,
sadly,
too, to the extent that there's, I mean, if misogyny, or more specifically, I guess, sexism, you know, misogyny being the sort of the practice that, that keeps you in line with the sexist sort of set of rules.
Exactly.
If sexism has is a sort of almost like a roadmap for the way that some people feel that, you know, life should be, essentially, I imagine that in this day and age, that ambiguity, the ambiguity that's coming with the progress that you mentioned, provides creates anxiety. Right. Like,
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Like, I'm, you know, I'm being told that these are the law of physics, but yet I'm watching a hammer float up a little bit sometime. And what Trump did came in and he sort of like he edified and made re-explicit, if you will, these existing laws, and brought some sense of, like, you know, reduction in anxiety, like things aren't changing.
I mean, I think that's exactly right. He shored up the existing social hierarchy, especially after the Obama era. And in a way, his, you know, his incompetence, his ignorance, and his moral obtuseness showed people something that, sadly, to many Americans was reassuring, which is the least qualified, least promising, least morally upright white man can occupy a position of ultimate power in this country, even today, over a well-qualified white woman and succeeding a well-qualified black man.
Okay.
And that, yeah, we shouldn't expect equality will come as good news to dominant group members.
All right, so let me just ask you this lastly. Like, when I describe Trump as fulfilling that for, you know, a certain segment of the voting population, I also think of Jordan Peterson providing that for adolescent teenage boys, frankly, who are, you know, also trying to navigate this world. Like, I need some clarity, and this nuance that's involved, like, you know, particularly because things are changing, you know, sort of societally. And then, of course, you know, within me as an adolescent boy, things are, you know, changing. Like, that must be helpful.
Yes, I do think it's a profoundly soothing message that you're entitled to compete to be top lobster, as, you know, and his audience isn't exclusively, but is predominantly white young men who feel inadequate or surpassed by historical subordinates. And it's such a shame, because there's room for a much healthier message of, you don't have to envisage your entire life as, or even much of it, as competitive. And you don't have to think about things in terms of these social and achievement-based hierarchies. And when you do think of them in those terms, sometimes you'll lose, and that's just life.
Right.
That's something the rest of us kind of, and I should say too, many white men also learn to accept and embrace and think, you know, this is just, I don't have to be the best at something. But I think Peterson is reinforcing the message that for those who've expected to be, you know, historically dominant, that he's reinforcing that expectation rather than trying to challenge or undermine it, or give the message that I think is much more consistent with tough love, which is, yeah, you won't always win or dominate, and that's okay. Life goes on.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you write about Rush Limbaugh, and I've been saying for years that's exactly what he does. It's just like, you know, when there's some ambiguity, I'm going to tell you that there's not, and I'm going to make this a lot easier for you. And also, just coincidentally, you came out on top.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart way of thinking about that particular political shtick. It's resolving those ambiguities. And it's a very soothing message because you're provided with an out to the sense that you're losing. And the art of losing is hard to master, as the famous line by Elizabeth Bishop goes. But master it we must.
Indeed. The book is Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. Kate Mann, we will put a link at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Very interesting stuff. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciated it.
Take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. It's all gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive.